on the Goldman trading floor when middle of financial crisis, and our swaps desk, one of the best swaps desks in the world, having like zero idea what their risk is, like within the nearest $100 million mark, right? And the
That's
lack of
crazy.
transparency caused by a legally enforced financial system where in crisis mode, legal enforcement, the ability to rely on that basically goes to zero. Like it addresses like two of your points around the problems with the financial system that is based on legal enforcement and the lack of transparency because of that. So we'll save that for later in the season.
What's up, everyone? We are now almost 1 month out from DAS London, the largest institutional conference in all of crypto. That's happening March 18th through the 20th, obviously in London. This one's going to be a blast. We are almost 10 times oversubscribed for tickets, which is pretty nuts. So again, we've had to lower the discount to Bell 10, and better yet, make sure you bring your friends. We sell a four pack of tickets. Find people in your company, bring your boss, bring your family, bring your girlfriend or boyfriend, whatever it is. Just go. You're going to get a discount if you use that team pack. Run, don't walk. Make sure you go get those tickets today. And cheers and see you in sunny London town.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer, the views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. This is a very special episode of Bell Curve because this is a kickoff episode for season seven, the multi-chain endgame, and I'm introducing my co-host for the season, Hart Lambert. Hart, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, Mike. Honestly, honored you made this offer to me. I'm really stoked. I think we're going to learn a ton, and I really do think the timing of figuring out like what this whole multi-chain world is going to look like couldn't be better. I feel like it is of the moment for sure.
Yeah, I'm pumped as well, man. There's no one that I'd rather be doing this with. And for new listeners to Bell Curve, this is just to give you like an overview of what we're going to be doing here. Bell Curve is a deep dive on one particular topic. It's going to be nine episodes in a season format. So there's going to be a kickoff, which is one that you're going to hear today. Hart and I are going to walk you through the big themes and sort of meta questions that we're going to be asking the season. There are going to be seven interviews throughout the course of the season, and then we're going to conclude with a wrap-up as well. And just to maybe, I'll sort of kick us off for the why, like why we're doing this now, and then I'd love to get your response to this, Hart. But the reason we're tackling a pretty broad topic here, the multi-chain endgame, is I think we're at a unique moment in time where some of the dynamics that we had taken for granted in crypto are changing. So, you know, I think a lot of folks in this space, I know not everyone would agree with this, have accepted the idea that we're going to be living in a world of multiple chains. But I think just how many chains there actually are going to be is a question that not a lot of people would agree on. How those chains are going to interconnect, I think, is a question that many people don't agree on. And then I think we are going through a pretty unique moment in time of unbundling. And I think a lot of people call this modularity, but the basic building blocks of what make up a blockchain, just almost on a blocking and tackling sort of data, like settlement, data availability, execution, those are starting to get unbundled. But even on a more meta level, we're starting to unbundle protocols from their assets, from their security models. And it's raising a lot of questions. And I think it's going to make people have to question some foundational assumptions that they've held for a long time in some cases. So that's why, to me, this is such an interesting. That's why I think I'm so excited to do the season. It's kind of a much needed update to at least my own personal mental model for where crypto is headed. But what do you think?
Yeah, no, Mike, I fully agree. I'd add even like there's even some technical considerations here, like how in this multi-chain world will apps be built? Like this goes a little bit to I'll call it like market structure. And so like are apps going to be built on one chain, their own chain? Are they going to be built with different components on different chains? How will that work? What types of applications will pick one to, like programming paradigm versus another? The other angle I'd add from this unbundling perspective is like on the community, kind of like social layer, are communities going to get like unbundled from their protocol? right? That's a wild concept to think through that I think you'd probably have much deeper thoughts on. And yeah, man, it's like, I think I'm going to sit through the season making a bunch of parallels to the history of finance and like financial technologies. And in finance, sort of one mental model we might work with is we've had a financial infrastructure that has developed a certain market structure, right? So in equities markets, which is probably what the audience understands best, in equities markets, we have high-frequency trading firms, and we have Robinhood doing like payment for order flow, so then it's cheap, and then it gets routed to these HFT firms and a certain set of exchanges, it has its own structure. But also in finance, there's like how the FX market works with a completely different market structure. And there's how like the bond market works with yet again, a different market structure. And for me, you're kind of like, as all these systems got more evolved, you saw worlds or different ways where they got connected. But the market structures, the ways they operate are quite different. And in a sense, I think there's some parallels here to how blockchain systems are going to get connected, what their market structures are going to look like, how they're going to operate. And yeah, man, I think we got some amazing guests that are going to help us understand that better.
I completely agree. And I love that we've got you here as well, because what I should have led with here, actually, Hart, if you were starting to allude to this a little bit, but can you just give a couple of seconds on your background, actually, as a, many people probably know you today as a crypto founder and someone who's very technically oriented, but you actually got your start cutting your teeth in the world of bonds and bond trading, which just makes for such a unique perspective. Can you just say a couple of words about how you wound up here?
Sure, man. Okay, so I did study computer science and was like nerdy that way. There's a whole funny story about like when I graduated, there was like no tech scene in New York at all. This is like,
which is so funny given what's happening today. I feel like it's totally flipping.
It's a wild thought, honestly, and it shows just what can happen a decade. But there was no tech scene in 2005. I'm Canadian, needed a visa, so I was really gonna have to work at a big bank if I wanted to stay in New York. And then I'm like, well, if I'm working at a big bank, I might as well try like the front office thing. And so I got a job as a US government bond trader, working with a bunch of other Canadians, which is quite funny. And I ended up trading government bonds, which is a very old school finance job. It's like one of the older markets on Wall Street. And we had a very like kind of techie way, like arbitrage focused way of how we would provide liquidity in markets. But it is going to be quite interesting, honestly, when we talk about later in the season, like intents and some of the ways interop works, because a lot of these systems look very much like my first job with bond trading, like RFQ systems and the way order flow auctions work. These are like the more protocolized versions of what we did on Wall Street. Anyways, I did that for a while. Started a fintech business that grew up alongside Robinhood, which also kind of gives me a perspective of how Robinhood shook up the market with payment for order flow and offering trading for free. And then I've been in crypto full-time since end of 2018.
Yeah, it's going to make for, I think, a really interesting contrast for the season, because obviously crypto is bleeding edge tech, and a lot of the dynamics that exist in crypto are sort of perfectly inverse or flipped from, traditional Web 2 or TradFi or whatever. But there's a lot of similarities as well. And I think there's good reason to believe that some of the dynamics that have played out in more established markets will play out in crypto also. And one of the things that we're going to talk about this season as well is the sort of currency element to this, because I think this is most apparent in Ethereum, where I think there's a little bit of a divergence in the roadmap today, and maybe two separate camps forming of, I don't want to be overly, prescriptive there, but I think there are some folks who want Ethereum, the protocol, to compete a little bit more, and some folks who are much more interested in Ethereum, the network's export, which is its asset as a currency. And, the Venn diagram of people that understand deeply, the history of monetary systems and money, and the people that understand, intricately the architecture of blockchains is so low. I mean, it's such a small Like, it's this wide as a Venn diagram. But I think there are lots of lessons that, you know, we could learn if there was more domain overlap there. But why don't we just start, Hart, from a kind of the most basic perspective, and maybe as a narrative arc for this particular episode, we're going to start with some questions that seem obvious and then try to confuse you as we go further into the episode, and then hopefully answer a couple of questions as we move to the end. But Hart, what do you think?
Yeah, let's go. I'm already confused. We're confused, Mike. We're confused together, right?
100%.
So our goal is to unconfuse ourselves over 9 episodes.
This is the blind leading the blind. Right. Yeah, this is the blind leading. We should have led with that caveat. But I want to introduce the first theme of the season, actually, is interoperability. And maybe we could phrase this meta question as, if we believe that there's going to be a world of many different chains, how are these chains going to be connected? So Hart, maybe to start with, can you give listeners like your understanding, you know, if I could ask you to pontificate for a little bit here, like what this world of multiple chains is going to look like? Are we kind of in this more Solana world where there are going to be a couple big general purpose chains, or are we going to this million chain roll up world? Or give like kind of sketch a sort of vision for the audience, and then we'll get into what some of the bridging apparatus and kind of like the different models by which chains get connected to each other today.
Yeah, man, I love this. All right, let's go. So Mike, you and I have talked about this a little bit, but I do think you can zoom out and look at three camps of like blockchain ecosystems right now. And if I'm missing anybody, I apologize, right? Don't hate me on Twitter, right? But the three camps I'm going to label as Solana and like monolithic blockchains, right? Ethereum and layer twos and that type of layer two scalability, and like Cosmos. And I'll call it like the app chain thesis here. And I love that these three different ecosystems exist and coexist, because I actually think they're all learning from each other and they're all inspiring each other. And I guess if we're supposed to like state allegiances on this podcast before we get started, like I come from an Ethereum background mainly. I like a lot of the ethos of Ethereum, but I have a lot of respect for both of these other ecosystems. And I think that I'm not, in that sense, a maximalist anyway. So like the app chain thesis, which I think Cosmos has been teaching us a lot about, is very much bleeding into how people think about roll-ups and L2s. And if you're going to have a roll-up per application in the L2 space. And then I think a lot of the, like on the Solana, on the monolithic side, I think a lot of concepts of composability and the advantages of composability, and like some of the trade-offs you may make in order to achieve better composability, they're really pushing the envelope there too. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I would agree with those three sorts of ecosystems. I guess from my own personal background, I would put myself in the neutral camp of my philosophy on crypto for a long time has been, I actually would view it as a negative if any one of these ecosystems ended up being the way dominant. And the way that I would describe this is, I love the United States of America. I grew up in the U.S. I was one of those people who my parents told me the U.S. is the greatest country in the world. They didn't even provide the idea there might be an alternative perspective to that. But I also wouldn't want the U.S. to be the only country in the world. I think, you know, spice of life, competition, all that stuff is really good. So I love the idea that there are many camps out there, many different experiments being run. So that's the perspective that I come from. I think there are, but I would agree with you on that. And I think there's a little bit of a push-pull here when I think about how many different chains there are going to be. I think people come at this from a couple of different standpoints. There's kind of the, and I think crypto tends to go in like waves of overreaction. So we went from kind of this like Bitcoin and ETH era where like, you know, these chains are going to swallow the world and it's only going to be these one chain. Anyone that says anything else, you know, is not necessarily correct. And then, you know, we had this overreaction to that where I think the sort of multi-chain thesis originated in Cosmos. It spread over to Ethereum. And then we quickly swung to, no, it's going to be multi-chain and there are going to be a million rollups. And then we started to question that thesis a little bit because of some actual technical challenges that arose, right? And namely, interop, fragmentation of liquidity just made things really, really tough. And then we sort of overswung and recorrected to this idea of Solana, where everything is going to be on one chain. And I actually think if you squint at even the different architectures that exist, they're starting to try to solve a lot of the same problems already. Like, you could do a spectrum here. I think it is on the spectrum of cost to sovereignty, of maybe like you have a full stack app chain over here. Then maybe you have a sovereign rollup over here, right? Which is, you still control settlement and execution, but maybe there's some kind of common DA and consensus layer that you outsource things to. Then maybe there's this like OP stack law of chains, which is you outsource your settlement and you're not a fully autonomous chain. You kind of subscribe to this collective, right? This like bundling package that Optimism is trying to put together. Then maybe you're your own roll-up, you know, chain devoid of all of that. Anyway, there's this like whole spectrum of different things that you can be. And even Solana, like if you zoom in on the architecture of Solana, you have multiple different accounts, and those accounts are starting to now fight for more sovereignty over the way that Solana extracts rent and charges for computational resources. So I actually think there's like a lot of similarity across even all of these designs that look very disparate at the same time. And one of the things that I frankly find myself oscillating between quite a bit, and I don't think I have a clear prediction going into this season, is just exactly how many chains there are going to be. If I had to put my stake in the ground, though, I would say it's ultimately going to come down to sovereignty and the ability, like the desire for chains to extract the economic value that they create. I think that will ultimately be the most important, the single most important design principle for what the multi-chain is going to end up looking like. I probably fall on the spectrum that I think Cosmos got it basically right with their end game. I think Cosmos is constantly ahead of its time. And I would say that we're heading to a world of many different chains, although I'm more blurry on whether or not those are going to be, how those chains are going to connect and interact.
Yeah. Okay. So first off, I do like this like trade-off between sovereignty. Well, we're 2x sovereignty and
cost.
Sure. I like that a lot. I guess it's like to zoom out and then go back in for a second. To zoom out for a second, there's a lot of analogies made to like early days of the internet, right? And maybe I can make an analogy where picking your blockchain is like, am I building with Sun Microsystems computers or Linux computers or like Windows servers, right? And there are big differences here. And like the database you choose to connect them, and databases and blockchains look a lot similar in a lot of ways. There are big differences here. And it's very possible that your web, like web 1.0 startup would succeed or fail based off of the infrastructure you built it off of. But the thing that actually matters most is like, did you build a fucking application users cared about, right? Like users don't care what computers your thing runs on. And so I do want to zoom out and make it really clear that like we are going to be spending the season talking about the right architecture here. The real end game still is, can users just use the application? Does it work for them? And like that is going to be the multi-chain end game. It just works. And we're going deeper on how it just works. And so, yeah, to bring it back to interop, we have these different blockchain designs, and we now have really cheap block space. The other analogy that I think is kind of fun to compare to the first dot-com bubble. People were all, this hype cycle around the internet was so big. People were laying fiber everywhere. There was all this fiber that got laid that nobody used for a decade. But that dark fiber got turned on 10 years later. It was like a complete overinvestment at the time. Dark fiber got turned on 10 years later and was literally what allowed like YouTube to exist, right? And like Facebook. Stuff like that. And so I very much think we hit this sort of innovation cycle where blockchains were a concept, got proven as kind of being cool, useful in a certain way, but expensive to use. All the VC money and all the research energy poured into how do we scale blockchains? Turns out we came up with some really great solutions, and they actually seemingly work pretty well. Now we have really cheap block space, which is great, and we probably have way more block space than we need. But now the problem is, how do we connect that? How do we make useful applications that go between these things? And I very much think we are going to have many chains. It's going to be a world of multiple chains. But I think the real question mark is, how do we connect that block space in a way that makes it transparent to the user, that it just, like, quote unquote, just works for the user?
I agree with that. And maybe, so agree with everything that you just said, and maybe to refine, just I'm getting on the books of prediction, which could be falsifiably proven wrong, is I think we're heading through a world of many chains, but I think the lines and distinctions in between what we think of as separate chains today will ultimately start to blur and become more meaningless over time. So if I had to say a prediction in 10 years, this won't even be a question, because the perception of everyone interacting in crypto is that it's all one chain, actually. So let's talk today, though, about how those different chains get connected. So basically, I would love, Hart, if you could give us an overview of the different types of bridges that exist today. I think when most users think about bridges, they'll think about, kind of like a classic third-party mint and lock bridge, like a wormhole or layer zero. And I would love if you could give us kind of like the broader spectrum of design space of different bridges that exist. Like, many people, like, obviously Across has a very different design, but many people would, I think it also is relevant to talk about things like IBC, right? Which is it's a type of bridge, right? And then there's even like canonical bridges from ETH mainnet up to Optimism or Arbitrum or something like that. So can you kind of just, for folks who don't understand, like, paint the design space of bridges for us?
Yeah, totally. I guess my two things, like, first of all, we should tell the audience that I do run a bridging protocol or an interop protocol called Across. Across is like an intent-based bridge, which we're going to talk about over the season, what that means. What I actually want to tell everybody is that, yeah, I do have some biases because I've been working on this Across protocol, but I try to approach stuff pretty open-mindedly here. So my goal here is to really figure out on this episode, like, what interop looks like with you. And I think, well, wouldn't mind your perspective, but I'm not going to be shilling Across here. Let's be clear about that.
Agreed. But I still trust your opinion. I trust your opinion. So, and I think, bridging is one of those things, and bridging in a sense, all right, let me get your take on this perspective. Bridging is kind of, in some senses, a myth in the way that we've historically thought about it. In that, when you, like, if you're talking about bridging your Ethereum from, like, ETH main chain, even up to a roll-up or something like that, the ETH isn't leaving the chain. There's just some sort of vehicle that transports a synthetic representation, a debt obligation, up onto another protocol. And then there's a spectrum of vehicles that are more or less credible or secure in their design. Would you agree with that idea?
Yeah. Mike, like, bridging here is so nuanced depending on what you're talking about. And so, oh man, it really can make your head hurt. So look, let me start going into the design space, but pull me out, like, if I'm going too deep on anything here.
No, go deep.
And some of these, yeah. Okay, so let's start with the idea of, first of all, blockchains, like, are state machines. They keep track of current state and independently, and they only know what exists on that blockchain. They need something else to tell them if something exists on a different blockchain. And actually, typically, that's called, like, the oracle problem. Like, how can a blockchain see something that's not, just internal to that own blockchain? Is you need a quote-unquote oracle to see a different chain. And frankly, the way I even got involved in Across is my other project, Uma, like, is focused in generally the Oracle space. And this is, like, why we had saw similarities here. So, okay, fine. So first thing to realize is like bridging here isn't easy or obvious. Blockchains are built to only know what happens on the blockchain. They're not built to know what happens on other blockchains. It requires significant work or significant things to do that. And you could kind of also say this, there's an argument that this actually seems like you're a really hard problem because it's almost like you're building a meta blockchain to connect all the other blockchains. So they all have like coherent state. And I think it's sometimes it's lost that like bridging, it's like trying to build the perfect blockchain. There's trade-offs here, right? Okay, so put that aside. Then I'd say, at least conceptually, you can think of bridging as doing one of two things. You bridge messages. So I'm sending messages between chains, or you're bridging value. I'm sending like value, like tokens between chains. And this is also a false distinction because there's weird overlap in certain ways that we can talk about, but I think it's a useful mental model to say like, am I doing A or B?
Give us an example, Hart, because I think people have a pretty good mental model for bridging value. And we actually, on our last episode with Dan Robinson, talked about the similarities between a DEX and a bridge, or an exchange and a bridge in many instances. But give us an example, because I think a lot of people have heard of this idea of like general message passing and sort of understood at a high level what it is. But can you get a little bit more specific about what a message is and maybe even walk us through one or two examples?
Yes. So, okay. So one way that I could send a message or not send value, actually a pretty obvious way is governance parameters. I'm just gonna make a super concrete example. So the Uniswap DAO votes for a set of parameters on Ethereum mainnet where the UNI token primarily is, and they want to pass those governance parameters to a different chain. Let's call it like BNB, right? You're not gonna bridge value there. Like, cause, and it's also interesting to think about that. How much is that message, quote unquote, worth, right? Like if those governance parameters could change the Uniswap deployment on BNB, and they couldn't do this. This isn't true. I'm making a hypothetical example, right? But if you did design a protocol where you could pass parameters that could change the protocol on BNB such that you could drain the protocol, well, that message is worth a lot, right? So you have this sort of arbitrary value to this message, but that's an example of where you're bridging a message and not bridging value. The other examples here are related to, or a lot of them are related to when you are actually bridging value. So if I have what I'm going to call like a lock and mint style bridge, I could have a smart contract on my source chain. Let's call it Ethereum again in this example, where I'm going to lock assets on that source chain, like let's call it native Ethereum. And I'm going to send a message from that source chain to my destination chain. Let's make it be a layer two roll up, where I'm going to then mint a representation of the source chain Ethereum on that roll up, right? That's another way where you are actually passing a message, but that message is being used to pass value.
Got it. What's also even helpful for me to understand, and listeners of past bell curve seasons will know that we use this analogy a lot, but if you think about the balance sheet of the bridge, you know, you could think about the liability side of the balance sheet being, in this example, the Ethereum that's sort of locked up, right, in a smart contract on Ethereum in most instances. And then you could think about the asset being this sort of synthetic, you know, message, you know, representation of Ethereum that exists on another chain. That's another sort of mental model to think about the balance sheet construction of bridges.
Totally. But I agree. And let's now think about it from the perspective of like a new rollup, right? Or any new chain. If you're any new chain, you really do need a way for value to get to your chain. And you often need a way for messages to get to your chain too. Most every new chain has some sort of, many new chains have what I'll call a canonical bridge that is the default chain mechanism to potentially do this lock and mint style value transfer and potentially do arbitrary messaging too. So it's interesting to think through the fact that, like, base, and again, there are exceptions to this, so I want to be clear, but if we make it like every Optimism superchain or Arbitrum Orbit chain, all of these chains come with a canonical, quote-unquote canonical way of bridging value to that roll-up and passing messages. But this bridge is designed to be super secure for the most part, because it's supposed to be the canonical thing, the thing you're optimizing for, first and foremost, is security. And so in those designs, you can bridge value and you can bridge tokens using the canonical bridge. It's relatively expensive to do that. And it takes some time, not too much time, to go from Ethereum to the rollup. But then in order to fulfill all of the optimistic type guarantees, it takes like 7 days to go the other direction, to come off the rollup onto mainnet. So like a nuanced example of how most chains, there are exceptions, have a, in a sense, a canonical lock and mint bridge and arbitrary message bridge. Yeah, Mike, I don't know. I can keep going. Different directions to go here.
No, this is, that's very helpful. And I think for listeners who are sort of wondering, right, there are, in the instance of, like, let's say a canonical bridge, which is, let's say you accept the least amount of trust assumptions, but there are these meaningful trade-offs that you make in terms of UX, either the cost or the 7-day wait period in the example of something like Optimism, right? Yep. So I think, you know, Hart, how would you start to answer the question that obviously we're moving towards a world where there are going to be many disparate chains, and that could be, you know, the separations exist maybe broadly across large ecosystems, right? So there's Ethereum, Cosmos, and Solana ecosystems. And there's like marginally better, in some cases much better, interop in between those ecosystems, right? So Solana, you almost have atomic composability. Within the world of Cosmos, you have IBC, which is very good interoperability as well. And then in Ethereum, that's probably where you have the most fragmentation of interop, because you've got obviously great atomic composability on main chain, but as soon as you move up into the rollups, each one within their different bundle of rollups is trying to solve for interop, and they are at varying degrees, but they will definitely solve that. But then there's the question of interoperability between rollups, which seems like a thorny thing. So, and then even you could think about big ecosystems sort of trying to connect between like Ethereum to Cosmos sorts of interop. So, you know, when you think about the method that these very disparate, like the wider gulfs of distinction exist, you know, how do you see the connections and interop working?
Yeah. I mean, Mike, we're going to spend a season talking about this or and elements of it, but yeah, man, and this is the big question. And I kind of think there's two directions to go. One direction is you try to send messages and or send value between these chains in a faster and more secure way. You just keep like iterating. I like, let's make it faster. Let's, well, keeping it secure and cheap. So we're going to go cheaper, faster, and not let things get less secure. And so we're just going to have better connections between things. I think the other angle is you actually do something different. And this is where I think the intent-based idea becomes really interesting. And the key observation here is that for most of what you're doing on blockchains, there is a defined value associated to it, which is very different from how like Web 2 works, right? Like Web 2, you don't know the value of the Instagram message you're sending. You don't know, yeah. Right? But in Web 3, you actually have like, okay, I'm trying to buy this much Dogecoin. Like I know how much that's worth. Or I'm trying to buy this NFT for this much money. I know how much that's worth. And this is where, you know, I do come from a bit of a finance background, but there's this other intent-based idea where I could actually have somebody do that action for me. Like they literally could do the thing for me on my behalf, spend their own money doing that, and just as my funds are escrowed until I quote unquote verify that they fulfilled their intent. And the path here is that this other alternative, when I can kind of put a dollar value on some of these interop messages, is we could have this third-party network of searchers, solvers, relayers, fillers, there's different names for them, but go and be filling users quickly, very fast, and doing composable type things because they're fronting their own money. And then we're actually able to use the slower pipes, the slower connections between chains to verify that securely. And so I think one of the things that we'll get more clarity on over the season is like, how do these two things interact? Like this intent-based framework where interoperability, or at least many forms of interoperability and composability, are happening because we have third-party people filling with their own balance sheet, so doing the action with their own balance sheet, and then using slower pipes to verify it? Or are we going to go down the path of just making the pipes be faster and cheaper? Or are we doing both, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really great sort of question to pose that we're going to be exploring for the rest of the season, and a really good transition into the sort of second big theme of the season, which is this paradigm of intents. And this was a buzzword, I feel like, even a couple months ago. And I would love, Hart, if you could define for listeners, you know, you were starting to kind of get into it a little bit with the design of Bridges Like Across, but, you know, it's relevant for even order flow auctions and DEX design. And can you just give us an overview, you know, what when we're talking about intents, what are intents? And then we can get into some of the implications of, like, what does it mean to design an intent-centric broader topology or an intent-centric app or something like that?
Yeah, totally. I was getting into this, but okay, what are intents? I mean, it literally is the word. It's like, what is my intent to do something here? I think you really need to define it in contrast to what a transaction on like Ethereum today is. So a transaction is like, here is the exact execution I want to do. And an intent is, here's the outcome I want. This is what I'm intending to do. And it's more abstract and lots more wiggle room, potentially infinite wiggle room in how you get there. You just want the output.
Yeah. It's just as a handy little like heuristic, the way someone described it is you're hard coding the output as opposed to hard coding the input, basically, if you have one sentence.
And I think there's two interesting ways. So let's talk about just doing a DEX trade, right? Well, actually, I'm sorry, I misspoke already. Let's just saying I have Ethereum and I'm trying to buy Dogecoin, right?
Yeah.
Two ways of doing this. The transaction way is take my Ethereum, go to take half, like I use like the one inch routing algorithm or something. I say, okay, half is going to go to Uniswap, a quarter is going to go to whatever, some other exchange, but here's how I exactly want you to execute these transactions on chain. And at the end of this execution, I'm going to have this much Dogecoin, right? Mm-hmm. The intent version of doing this is saying, hey everybody, who can fill me? I want to get the most Dogecoin, and maybe it's a limit order. It has to be at least this much, but I have my one Ethereum here. I want to get the most Dogecoin possible. You guys go figure it out, right? And the market participants go and figure out how much they could possibly fill this user for. So from my finance background, like the intent-based structure here makes total sense. It's a request for quote, right? It's there's an order that comes in and we're running an auction of some sort to see which market maker will fill the user at the best price, and that's it. And you don't care how the market maker actually fills the user. It's like they could be selling off of their own balance sheet, they could be going short, they could be buying from exchange X or exchange Y or whatever else, doesn't matter. It's their thing to figure out.
What's up, everyone? We are now almost 1 month out from DAS London, the largest institutional conference in all of crypto. That's happening March 18th through the 20th, obviously in London. This one's going to be a blast. We are almost 10 times oversubscribed for tickets, which is pretty nuts. So again, we've had to lower the discount to Bell 10, still hooking you guys up, getting you a 10% discount on Bell 10. And we've onboarded a whole bunch of new speakers. So that's Dan Tapiero of 1RT, Pascal Gauthier of Ledger, Anthony Scaramucci, the Mooch himself, Michael Sonnenschein of Grayscale, Brad Garlinghouse of Ripple, Sergey Nazarov of Chainlink, Matt McDermott of Goldman Sachs, their global head of digital assets, Stani Kulichov, Danny Masters, the list goes on. This one is going to be an absolute blast. Make sure you don't miss it. And better yet, make sure you bring your friends. We sell a 4-pack of tickets. You're going to get a discount on that. So find people in your company, bring your boss, bring your family, bring your girlfriend or boyfriend, whatever it is, just go. You're going to get a discount if you use that team pack. Run, don't walk. Make sure you go get those tickets today. And cheers and see you in sunny London town.
One of the questions that I think this brings up, and I'm curious to get your response on this, is ultimately in this intent-centric paradigm, who are the intermediaries? And are we needlessly introducing a new set of intermediaries here, which really, there's a different word depending on which application we're talking about. Is it a searcher? Is it a solver? Yeah. Is it a filler? Is it a builder? And realistically, what it looks like is we're converging on, think hedge fund, roughly, right? Think very crypto native, very, infra savvy hedge fund or market maker. And what you're solving mostly is a combination of optimization and inventory management challenges. And I would be curious, Hart, I mean, there's in some sense, there's a massive benefit to the user, which is these the messages or the assets basically get to move along the most secure path, right? The canonical, slow abridging path. But you're also introducing this new intermediary and you're sort of raising, I think another nuance that gets lost in this is that, when you talk about solving an inventory challenge, it obviously implies the existence or the requirement to have inventory. And so it raises the barrier to entry as opposed to a lot of the original searchers that were doing this, like solving MEV problems on Ethereum, you had the benefit of flash loans. And so you actually had like no barrier to entry for, so it literally could be like one or two person shop. So like a 14-year-old out of, India or something like that was solving these problems. But now, as soon as you have to front capital on users' behalf, then you're raising the barrier to entry and it looks much more hedge fundy. So what would you think about that as a trade-off? Should we be upset about that? Does that not matter? Is that inevitable? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's nuanced. So first of all, I think the thing to differentiate here is intents in a single chain context versus intents in a multi-chain context. So intents in a single chain context could just be I'm just trying to figure out the optimal route through a bunch of open smart contract protocols to fill something. And the only barrier to entry here is that I'm smart. So you could actually say MEV searchers in the kind of Ethereum MEV supply chain this gets very nuanced when you start doing sex dex arbitrage or whatever. But if you ignore some of those off-chain components, MEV searchers, your only barrier to entry is just being smart. And I can get in there and do this thing. In this multi-chain world, what's really being highlighted by the intent architecture, like you said, is we are introducing a third-party actor and they have a new barrier to entry in most of these designs, which is that they have some balance sheet. They have some access to capital. And I think it is a very fair and legitimate criticism to kind of be that sort of sucks, right? And I'll tell you from my own background, we've talked about this, the idea that in the kind of DeFi 1.0, you could be, because of flash loans, be a 14-year-old kid in your parents' basement and liquidate a $100 million position because you constructed a transaction that flash borrowed it to do that liquidation. Is so cool just conceptually. no barrier to entry, permissionless innovation, that 14-year-old kid had access to $100 million of capital, even though it was like within an atomic transaction, right? That's kind of cool. So I do think, I do kind of like dislike the idea that there is this capital requirement barrier to entry in the intent architecture. However, I do not think at all that this is equivalent to like the traditional financial system. The traditional financial system, you do not have just a barrier to entry of capital. You have regulatory, like all sorts of things that are like massive barriers to entry that make innovation or the ability to actually do something new there really, really hard. A classic example is like what you'll call like an ISDA agreement. It's like International Standards for Derivatives Association or something like that. And it's a legal document that you need to get signed with all the major banks. So Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, if you are going to trade derivatives with them. And getting an ISDA master agreement signed as a new hedge fund, like a freaking hedge fund, is an incredibly challenging thing to do. And you've got just like huge barriers to entry. So my argument is that if we build a DeFi system or like build crypto where you do have third-party actors that are providing a useful interop service, and they are permissionlessly allowed to access and leave that system, I think we're in a good spot. I'd prefer they didn't have a capital requirement, but I don't think it's the end of the world.
Yeah. You know, for a representation of ISDA, that was actually in The Big Short. If you remember Brad Pitt's character, he actually had to get brought in to help. I can't remember the name of the smaller hedge fund actually trade or express their trade. And I tend to agree with you, Hart. I think it's an interesting idea to explore throughout this season. I think another where I tend to land on this particular issue is that creating and managing a global financial system is hard. It's sort of, you know, if you really examine the assumption that retail, anyone in retail should just be able to, you know, to manage that, I'm not actually sure that really holds up. And I think if we can obviate some of the more negative trade-offs that have existed in TradFi, then it's probably worth the corresponding benefit to user experience that we get from this. But I want to, oh, sorry. Do you want to?
No. I was just going to say, like, we should move on. But I do agree. It's like the kind of the first version of DeFi, like, and I was a little bit naive here too. The idea of just having these very simple, very pure protocols that just like do it all, right? There's a really nice concept there. But the reality is, like, if you're going to scale this thing to like replace our financial system, there are complexities that exist. Like, they just are. And so we're going to face some trade-offs here. And if we want to build really like, the answer is not always going to be the simplest thing. Even just looking at how Ethereum has developed, right? Like the MEV supply chain for Ethereum, complex. And, you know, no one's trying to make it complex. It's just scale, nuance, usability, it grows. So anyways, keep going, Mike.
This is a little bit of an aside, but it's become popular recently to poke fun at the Ethereum roadmap and say, look at how complicated this is. Look at a diagram of how cell phones speak to one another. You'd be like, this is incredibly complicated. You know, anything that is large, global, you know, widely adopted, the intricacies of that system, I guarantee you, are extremely complex. And, you know, I got to defend Vitalik here. It's like creating a 6-year product roadmap is freaking hard. What's the alternative? To just not have a product roadmap? I'm like pushing back on the pushback to Vitalik and the Ethereum roadmap. I've also had the pain, and I'm sure you have as a founder as well. Selling a vision, creating a roadmap that far into the future is difficult to do to even like 10 people or 50 people, let alone an entire industry, and have you get picked apart. So I had to defend Vitalik on that one. But I want to lay the groundwork here, and you and I are going to talk about this with Chris, because Chris Goes has actually dropped a little bit of alpha. He's our first interview for the season. But I've now referenced this a couple times. I find it very interesting. One of the... And it's going to introduce our next topic, which is modularity. But, you know, this is a blog post from the Enoma blog. And if there are any intense nerds out there, or frankly, just blockchain architecture nerds out there, I'd highly recommend this as a resource. But we're skipping all the way down to the end of an article that Chris wrote on the intent-centric topology. But the conclusion of this blog is a paragraph titled "Heterogeneous Security and the End of Supply-Side Blockchain Economics." And just a quote, "Right now, our industry operates on the basis of a world model one might call supply-side blockchain economics. Organized groups raise large amounts of capital to launch new chains, recently rebranded to rollups, then dribble it out to application developers expected to build on top. Demand, say, for block space, is implicitly expected to follow supply. Without conducting a thorough analysis, I attribute the dominance of this world model to the concordance of two factors. First, an understanding of platforms as the primary value capture sink malappropriated from Silicon Valley Fang, and the observable power law of assets, most commonly measured in USD price. I'm going to skip some here. An intent-centric conception flips this model on its head. Intents are demand. They come from users who want something in the world, and what they want typically isn't to just fill the coffers of platform operators. Users care about hand-grown organic block space just about as much as they care about hand-grown organic cell or Excel cells. Now users want block space that follows certain consensus rules, etc. But here, I'm actually just going to start to paraphrase here. Basically, what Chris is saying is that initially, you know, people had this mental model for creating platforms that are going to lock, you know, specific apps into it. And if you have the experience of in a transaction-based paradigm where you are responsible for having an opinion and actually executing all of the inputs, right, the hard-coded inputs, then you almost have this mental model of like, I need to go onto this blockchain and do all of these actions. There's sort of a capture there. But when you have a demand-centric or an intent-centric view of the world, suddenly some of the things, it's much more, people are less opinionated, the user, about the specific qualities of the block space, and they can kind of pick and choose. And this flip from supply-side oriented construction or a supply-side sort of paradigm to a more demand and intent-centric paradigm, it has the impact of unbundling the parts of a blockchain that had previously been bundled. So the way that Chris defines this is four things. Protocol, which in the case of Ethereum here would be the EVM, which supports smart contracts. Specific security model, which is Gasper with a validator set. A history, including a nominal asset, ETH, and a community, people who self-identify as members. And, you know, previously, before this sort of world of intents, if you had an action that you wanted to do, like trade something on Uniswap, you were subject, because I wanted to go do this thing, I was subject to the security assumptions of something like Ethereum. I had to get lumped into this entire thing. And often, like, that's how Ethereum kind of built its community as well, right? Like, you went to something on Uniswap, you maybe traded, maybe made some money on Dogecoin or Aave or whatever was, I don't mean to compare those two, but just like something in the early days, and you kind of sucked into this whole thing, right? And then you started to love Ethereum, and all those things were bundled together. Now, this is all setting up the question that I want to ask you, Hart, which is the third big theme of this season is modularity. And I think there are a couple of different ways that you could define it, but let's just talk about modularity within the context of unbundling things. And what I'm particularly interested in, and I think we could zoom in and look at Ethereum here, but just to be clear, this is a topic that every single blockchain is going to have to grapple with at some point, is, you know, Ethereum is at this very interesting point in the roadmap where they are pushing users and assets, you know, off of their actual main chain, the platform. They're pushing it up onto rollups. And in some senses, they're actually deprioritizing or not improving main chain performance, which would be the protocol. But what they want, the hope, is that they're going to be more competitive on the asset, their export, their dollar asset ETH, or not dollar, their asset ETH. And so, Hart, how do you broadly think about this idea of when we start to decouple blockchains from this bundle of things that they had historically been? You know, if the objective of ETH is to create this export, which is a money-like thing, how are you going to compete, right? If we're in a world where there's an increasingly large gulf in between the performance of the protocol and the use of the asset. Does that question make sense?
Performance of the protocol and use of the asset. I mean, wow, Mike, there's a lot to unpack here, right? Like, And I want to go back to some of the Chris Ghost stuff too, because it's like super interesting, and I'm like very excited for that conversation too.
Yeah.
But on the Ethereum thing, it's like, and maybe this equates to how I interpret Chris's thing, it's just like, what does the user want to do? And so Ethereum, do they really care about, like, this is funny, does Vitalik really care? Does the ETH actually care about the price of ETH? I mean, they do to some degree. But I actually really think of those guys as caring most about, like, hey, can this thing be maximally useful to solve a problem? And we'll kind of like figure out the economics after. Maybe you disagree with me on that. But from that perspective, they're like, okay, we just want Ethereum is this super secure, stable thing. And there's this mental model where we're going to have the main net be this expensive to use but rarely use settlement layer, and we do all the lighter weight stuff on the edges. And we are really trying to just help users have a good experience here. And I guess maybe I'm taking this not in the direction you wanted, but to relate it back to what Chris Goes is saying, there is this really interesting example when he's being all like this intense maximalist that he seems to be, where he's saying, hey, what the hell does the user want to do? Like, let's build the system to execute whatever they want to do. So let's build the thing where the users define the action, and then the block space and the whatever, like, figures it out and fills it for them. And I guess maybe when you were talking through that, where my head went, and again, I'm going to keep trying to make traditional finance analogies, you have like the CME, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. It's like the biggest futures exchange in the world. And I'd argue they are the opposite of intent-based. They're monolithic, right? They're like, here's the way our futures contracts are defined. Here's the way they work. Here are our margin requirements. Everybody like uses this system. They have provided a very useful service, but they are kind of monopolistic. They've got a huge amount of regulatory capture. They're kind of evil, right? right? Like they're kind of evil, right? But they define, here is exactly how you use our system, right? And I was sort of thinking about that as Chris, you reading Chris's quote. It's like, that's kind of his critique of some of these other kind of architectures. And the flip side of that is like, the Robin Hood limit order, right? It's like, here's the limit order. I want to sell stock. I want to, you know, buy this much stock, right? And I do not care. You guys figure out how to fill me at the best price. And look, I'm not saying that high frequency trading are good people. They're kind of evil too. But like, if we extract our kind of feelings around high frequency trading and some of that other stuff, you have a system where the user is defining their intent, and then the infrastructure is being built to fill that. And it's being competitive kind of at every level to fulfill that. And when you were reading Chris Goes' piece, I was like, that seems kind of cool.
I agree. I totally agree with that. And I do think a user-centric view of the world is probably, ironically, it's almost like not the dominant view in a lot of it feels like, right? This was my takeaway from the Meb season. It's like, where's the user in all of this? Where's their input? But I think let me try to get a little bit more specific with what I mean here. What if like users are coming, and I'm not picking on Ethereum here, but let's just take the example of Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin does this thing where it makes the properties, the specific properties that it's chosen to create its block space, make it unusable to like do things on, right? Like 10 minute block times, right? Extremely small blocks. But what it does try to compete on is its export as a money, right? Like that's what Bitcoin is trying to do. And if you look, you can just look at the amount of transactions up until recently, ordinals, right? But like, you know, for years it was like a one-way trip down. Like they had this very intentional design philosophy, and I feel like Bitcoin, the network, chose to compete on the basis of money. And if you're money, you're trying to compete on this this axis of kind of like distribution, you know, permissionlessness, censorship resistance, etc. But that makes the network itself much less usable. And I kind of sort of see the world dividing in these two. Like the Solana thesis would be, I just want to have this protocol that is extremely performant. You can do all of this stuff here. I guess the question is, what is that long-term going to do to the asset? Maybe because, you know, you have to solve all of these problems, there are some parts of Solana's design that does make it more prone to centralization. Maybe that ultimately makes its asset less useful, like less attractive as a money. But I think that's the reason Ethereum gets a lot of this is, A, they're just the incumbent. They have more activity, so they're more interesting to talk about than any other protocol. But I do feel like they're in between these two outputs, because it seems like they're aligning more on the, we want our export to be money. But if they're doing that, then they're necessarily going to have to, feels like they're going to have to make trade-offs on what the users want to do on Ethereum today, so to speak.
Yeah, I see what you're saying now. And man, this is an interesting question. I mean, I agree on the Bitcoin side where it's like, okay, we're competing on money, we're digital gold. Like 5 years ago, that narrative wasn't maybe as settled, but it is like more now. And then they're kind of trying to break it with like the ordinals thing, which I think is kind of interesting too. But like, okay, yeah. So cool. We're trying to be the best digital money, right? And I do agree with this divide of like other, we're just trying to be the best smart contract platform. We're trying to be the best, I'll call it protocol, not money, right? Mm. I do agree that Ethereum is like somewhere in between, right? And I think the specific architecture reflects that, where the roll-up thesis, like from Ethereum, that's where they're focusing on the user and the usability. And then like on mainnet and the settlement layer, that's where they're focusing more on like the money, right? Where it's like, we're super secure and solid and all that kind of stuff. And look, like maybe that's a really good strategy, right? Where you kind of have like your different components focus on those different things, and that works out. I think it's almost like impossible to predict, but it goes back to like what we were both saying earlier in the episode, where we're like, okay, I'm really glad Solana exists. I'm really glad Cosmos exists. I'm really glad Ethereum exists. They're all learning from each other and pushing each other. I'm also really glad this kind of like, are we a money or a protocol type question? Because I mean, I want both, man.
Me too. Yeah, me too. And I'm interested to maybe start to cap this part of the conversation off, is I'm interested to understand if that's actually a real trade-off or not. And I'm interested to see the strategies, or let's say vectors of competition, that emerge if you want to compete on the protocol performant sort of, hey, come build your stuff here sort of use case, or the axis of like, you know, competing as a money, essentially. And I'd love to know, yeah, just like the playbooks and how those two things are different and whether or not there's a real tension there. All right. Moving on to the next sort of theme of the season, and it's related to this, is network effects. This is a question that I've been extremely curious about for, frankly, years in crypto. You know, if you look maybe and have one lesson from Silicon Valley and the wave of, you know, Web 1 and Web 2 companies, is that network effects are extremely real, and probably more relevant in the age of these digital networks than they've ever been. And crypto, if anything, feels like a more pure expression of that. So I've always kind of thought that we're operating in an industry with extreme power laws. The question, though, is, and this is where the modularity sort of complicates that, is at what layer in the stack do those network effects start to take hold? And if we zoom in on the definition of like some of the unbundling that's going on between, let's say, these four layers of settlement, consensus, DA, and execution, where are we getting the network effects, right? Is it within like one specific layer of like a layer one blockchain, like at the execution layer? Is it at the settlement layer where all the liquidity sort of lives? Or is it in an application? And ultimately, maybe all of our favorite blockchains from, you know, Cosmos to Solana to Ethereum ultimately end up kind of getting commoditized, and value flows towards the app layer that has the connection with the user. So, Hart, I would be curious. You know, I'd be curious if you walk into the season with any thoughts on or opinions on what layer in the stack network effects accrue to.
For interop specifically?
Yeah.
I think it's still very architecture dependent on where this stuff goes. So let's go back to like our TradFi examples and talk about like payment for order flow, like trading stocks on Robinhood, right?
Yeah.
To me, there's clearly three layers in the stack, and it actually does mirror what the intent architecture looks like. You have the application, so literally the Robinhood app here, which is clearly accrued value. It's a venture-backed business, and it IPO'd, right? Like it's something that accrued some value. Then you have the middle layer, which are like the HFT firms competing to fill Robinhood. And what's interesting there is like they make money, right? For sure. But they're hyper competitive. I think they could be more competitive. Like I was saying earlier in the season, it's not permissionless access to do this. There's lots of hurdles to become a new HFT firm. And then they do some like regulatory capture stuff and like all that. So I don't think this is at all perfect. But I would argue that less value accrues there from like venture capital. Like if you're a VC, you're not investing in HFT firms. They're profitable businesses, but they're not the thing that you invest in.
Right.
And then like what's also kind of really unknown is the sort of settlement layer. So there's like settlement clearinghouses, things like DTCC, like weird like financial infrastructure stuff. And those are also like there is value that accrues there, but I think there's a lot more wiggle room about what that like looks like or how they accrue value and how that works, standards there. Anyways, my analogy there is like in the intent-based architecture, I think you can make an argument. I think in any of these architectures, you can make an argument that the user application has the potential to accrue value because they own the user, and that's useful. If there are middle layers that are highly competitive and like permissionless and open, that doesn't seem to accrue value. And like a settlement layer in the intent architecture could also accrue value. But if we talk about the non-intent based version of this, right? So we're just sending messages between pipes. Well, okay, if somebody can own some of those messages between pipes, yeah, that makes like sense, like it could accrue value. And this is where, you know, Chainlink CCIP and Tunix, like I think Layer Zero, they're trying to define standards that they look at like the TCIP of the internet, trying to define standards where you connect blockchains and get people to use those standards and accrue value there, right? And I think this is really interesting and really hard to predict because on one hand, I want to say that, yes, if you can own those pipes, even if you're taking like a small fee, and we go down a world where we send a lot of messages through those pipes. So I think in the intent architecture, we use those pipes less. We still use them, but we use them like less than if we don't do the intent architecture. So if we are using those pipes a ton and you collect a small fee and you can own them, that does seem very profitable. But also like if you have a bunch of competing standards and there's other free standards and like, you know, it's pretty PvP right now. Like Chainlink and Layer Zero are pretty PvP in this too. So that's my, this is where I hope we get to learn more over the season and come up with more developed views here. But I think like trying to figure out where value accrues is hard.
I agree. I feel like for me, I think I go into this season, I've got three layers that I think are interesting in terms of where network effects accrue. One and two questions. So my predictions would be, I think there are network effects at the asset level. That's the least controversial, right? There's Lindiness. If you look at the way that you know, adoption is played out in currency markets today, it's like, you know, there are hundreds of different currencies, but there are really like six that have volume and liquidity, right? So I feel like probably something similar, right? Extreme power laws and network effects when it comes to currencies. And no matter how good the routing architecture, I think, of crypto ends up being, I think they're still just wanting to trade in and denominate your worth in like an asset that everyone else does, I think it's going to be extremely powerful. So I would say at the asset level, I also think at the execution level. So like the EVM is an area where there's clearly network effects around, right? I think the SVM is another example there. Even something like the Cosmos SDK, right? There are kind of these environments that have escape velocity. And once they get going, there's clearly some amount of network effects there. And then I think apps are ultimately going to have, maybe network effects is the wrong word, but definitely a lot of leverage just by, based on their proximity to the user. I think the questions that I have going into this season are, how do network effects at one layer of a blockchain bleed into the other? And what I mean by that is, like, here's an interesting question, right? When Avalanche launched as an EVM compatible chain, how much benefit of that ended up accruing to Ethereum, the protocol, or ETH, the asset? And this same question got asked when Eclipse launched as an Ethereum rollup, but it used the SVM. Who benefits more? Actually, the Eclipse one is actually probably more interesting because it was such a Rorschach test. I mean, if you were more Solana inclined, you were like, let's go, baby. This means more people from ETH building and making improvements to the SVM. And if you were in Ethereum, you were like, capitulation. You know, even the Solana people want to come over here. And there are probably benefits to both, but I think trying to quantify that. And another example, I'm maybe a little bit embarrassed. I would just love a great definition of what settlement really means. Like, what does that actually really mean? And what network effects accrue there? I would love to get crystal clear on that coming out of this season.
Okay. I mean, I should probably come up with a more technical definition of settlement, but the way I intend it, right, is there is an action and we are verifying that it happened, right?
Yeah.
So this is a non-issue when you're on a single blockchain, because it's literally, did the transaction execute or revert? And that blockchain is your settlement layer. So if I'm just executing on Ethereum mainnet, I know whether I settle or not by knowing whether my transaction executed or reverted, right? If I'm doing a transaction-based thing. Once I start going cross-chain, and it fits very nicely with this intense framework where I say somebody specified the output, and then you can imagine, okay, so this is the output they want, and we'll just make it a cross-chain swap. They want Dogecoin on chain B. The input is Ethereum on chain A, right? So how do I settle that? Well, I don't let the user lose their money until we verify that that happened. And so in a cross-chain context, the way I use settlement is like, there's an escrow. So their input assets are held in a decentralized, secure way until we verify that they got their output assets, and then their input assets are released. Right.
Yeah.
So that's my definition of settlement in this context. But yeah, Mike, you said like 15 other things I want to respond to. I probably won't respond to all of them. One point I was going to make is like, I think there is also a difference between network effects and where value accrues here.
Yeah, too. That's a really strong point. Yep.
And I was going to say specifically on the EVM and the like SVM, like I do very much agree that like the EVM has network effects around it. I'm very unclear how value accrues there. And I think, again, if we keep trying to make like analogies to past events, it's like Linux as a standard developed network effects in all sorts of really powerful ways. And it was very unclear how people were going to capture value around that. And then like Red Hat open sourcey stuff kind of did, but it did in ways that were like hard to predict and hard to see.
You know what? I'm going to add in two dimensions for us then. I think in addition to network effects, there's probably an additional filter of like value capture and user lock-in. Like where does that ultimately end up happening? That's probably the more interesting question, actually. Who gets to, you know, I know this is crypto and it's positive sum, but like, come on, I like to speculate. Like who's going to ultimately end up benefiting more? And I just feel like it's a very difficult question to answer, but a very interesting one, because the world is getting more complicated from where I sit in crypto. And I think it's an interesting question to ask.
Yeah, totally. And like, again, you know, I'm sure you have just like nothing on the show is financial advice, right? But it is interesting to see. We do, one of the cool things about crypto is you do have assets that, if there is a narrative or an understanding about how they could capture value, like price moves, right? And so there's a, you kind of get real time feedback around this too, which is pretty cool.
All right. So that kind of leads into, you know, we've got three more themes that we're going to be exploring. You know, one, we can just kind of, you know, we don't need to go super in depth here, but I think it's going to be very interesting to explore this dynamic of shared security in a multi-chain world. And shared security is actually somewhat of an old concept, I think, in crypto, but it's moving back into the fore with restaking. Restaking is, of course, you know, you're essentially rehypothecating your, you know, security, you know, from the perspective of it's your staking value from the perspective of Ethereum, the blockchain, and using that to provide security, economic security to other chains. And that could be like middleware on Ethereum. That could be providing security for like operators in a roll-up context, or it could be reaching across into other ecosystems. We did a great episode of Sriram and Zaki on, for instance, using rehypothecated Ethereum stake to provide security to Cosmos chains. And so, you know, and there are different models around the world of crypto you could take a look at. Over in Cosmos land, there's something called interchain security, different models of like replicated and partial security. There's also mesh security. Over in Avalanche, they have a very different way of thinking about things. But even in Bitcoin, there's a project called Babylon, which essentially exports the 10-minute timestamps of Bitcoin, and Cosmos chains are exploring using that to decrease their unbonding period. So there are all these, and again, just going back to the unbundling point, it's almost like, you know, Ethereum has a very specific security model, and this is kind of a way of exporting some of the specific security properties of Ethereum block space, as well as the actual security in the sense of market cap. And it kind of creates these linkages in between chains. So I don't know if you have any thoughts in particular on, I'm just very curious to see how this particular dynamic ends up tying disparate blockchains in the future.
Okay, so it's super fascinating. I feel like season 8 of Belker is going to be on restaking or something like that. Probably. And I find I am like a huge fan of Sriram and Eigenlayer and some of these concepts here too. When you're talking, Mike, I think the idea that's floating in my head, right, is like, of course you want to do more with less. The whole idea of like restaking is like, okay, let's use the same money, let's use the same economic security and do a lot more things with it, which makes all the sense in the world. The trade-off is that you're moving from a world of perfect security guarantees. So I can be like, this is exactly what's going to happen. I have for every dollar, like I have a one-to-one mapping between like my liabilities and my assets, if you will. And once you start doing this restaking stuff, you move into a more of a probabilistic thing. It's like in everything but a 7-sigma event, I should be okay. It takes some real black swan risk before something happens. And like, I actually think that's okay. I think that makes a lot of sense. Particularly because everything is transparent and auditable and we can actually look at the stuff. But it's different, right? And it's more complex. You want to talk about increasing complexity. There is a lot more complexity once you start intermeshing systems and doing things that should work 99.999% of the time, but you got to consider the times when they don't. So that's my only comment on this. Super fascinating, super supportive. Also extremely complex, and like proceed with some caution.
So completely agree. I think done multiple episodes on restaking at this point. I think where I come down on it is it's inevitable. The whole point of permissionless systems, like the trade-off that you have to make, is that they're permissionless. You don't actually get to have a say all the time in terms of how people use your system. So people are going to do it. People will probably end up making mistakes with it, and there will probably be some negative ramifications down the line, but it is the type of bold, you know, experiment that makes me excited about crypto. And there are massive benefits, you know, like it's a massive problem for new chains to, it's not really recruiting the validator, so to speak, but it's more, it's convincing stakers to stay with you across bull and bear markets. And why would I lock my, why would I suffer this opportunity cost of capital, locking it up, staking in this protocol that could go to zero, as opposed to something like Ethereum? So the ability, I think what it's going to end up doing is solving a massive economic challenge that a lot of these new protocols go to. And it's going to, just like roll-ups, like it's going to unlock this Cambrian explosion of innovation, but there are definitely going to be some negatives to watch out for as well. But another softer element of this as well, when it comes to shared security, is this alignment question, which sounds like this like silly, soft thing, but there is a social aspect of things as well. Like if I'm a Cosmos protocol and I'm doing something really close to the metal in Cosmos, like for instance, Stride as a liquid staking provider, it makes more sense for me to align myself with someone like the Hub and source replicated security from them, because in addition to these other benefits, like the Hub being able to provide Atom, you know, to like protocol and liquidity, it's also kind of like, yeah, we're building in Cosmos, we're a Cosmos thing, as opposed to being like, hey, yeah, we're in Ethereum, you know, we want to do Eigenlayer. So there is a soft, squishy kind of cultural thing when it comes to where you source security from. But I'm interested to see when that ultimately ends up breaking down the kind of alliances and interconnections that end up getting built across different chains. So I think that'll be something interesting to explore this season.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing I'll add, Red, it's like from the theme of the season, like to me, I'm actually quite curious how you, Mike, are going to thread shared security into this multi-chain endgame, right? And it's like, what does this enable from this multi-chain universe perspective? I honestly think you've done a lot more deep thinking here than I have, and I'm really kind of curious where this all goes, because I think it's less of an interop thing. I think this is more, there's something there that I don't think I quite grasp, and I'm quite curious to explore it.
Here's this is in my own observation. This directly came out of an episode that we did with Shreel and Zaki. But consider a world where, or the sort of mutual benefit from the perspective of Ethereum and Cosmos to use E3 staking. So the benefit from the perspective of a Cosmos app chain is that pain point that I described to you before. You know, okay, when it's a bull market, it's really easy to go recruit a network of validators, some, you know, depending on how high quality the project is, you know, some maybe high quality, maybe not. The problem is when you roll off into a bear market and everyone's like, probably a lot of people are just divesting from crypto writ large, but really it's like, should I really be validating this random chain that's been around for 12 months? And I don't know if this is going to work. Like, I want to move back into something that's secure, like ETH. One of the assets that Ethereum has is this network of like diehard stakers who are just going to keep providing economic security through bull and bear markets. And so the value proposition changes if you're lowering the opportunity cost of capital. You can be like, all right, I'm going to stake with Ethereum, but I'm going to opt into these extra risk assumptions, like these slashing assumptions, essentially, to earn this incremental yield. It's much easier from the perspective of a Cosmos app chain. And you also have to pay way less. Because if you, from the perspective of a Cosmos app chain, are like, hey, stay here, like keep your capital locked up to here, your emissions need to go like this, right? Like really, really high emissions. So you can actually bargain because the stakers on the other side now have their Ethereum locked up and they're just opting into this extra thing, you have to pay for less security. So that's the benefit to the Cosmos side of things. On the Ethereum side of things, there are certain applications that require a committee of different distinct entities to perform. So like an example would be in Zaki's case, like Sommelier, like that can't actually be done by a smart contract. And so there are these services that this more modular way of distributing security unlocks so that ETH can get a whole bunch of additional middleware services that it otherwise couldn't have before. And now what you had, like if you take this to its sort of logical conclusion, you had these two very distinct ecosystems of Cosmos app chains over here and Ethereum over here. But in a world where we've adopted, like restaking really takes off, maybe you view Cosmos as more of a design philosophy. And really, we end up in this, Ethereum is kind of this like shelling point asset, you know, shared security layer. But really, a lot of the apps end up looking like Cosmos. And the multi-chain endgame implication is, again, the blurring of the lines in between these different ecosystems, where today it feels like a very distinct line. In the future, it might be, you might think of Cosmos just as operating at a different layer of the stack than as Ethereum operates. And it actually doesn't feel like a distinct ecosystem at all. So that is why I'm interested in where shared security ends up shaking out.
Yeah. Okay. You made the connection for me. That was actually really useful. The way in the multi-chain context, restaking and things like Eigenlayer are a new tool that makes it, frankly, cheaper to start a new blockchain and innovate in blockchain space, whatever. So yeah, obviously that's going to influence our multi-chain endgame. Like, we have a new tool that in a very clever way makes it a lot cheaper to bootstrap a new consensus, a new chain. And that could and probably will impact like the market structure of how this multi-chain world ends up looking because of the benefits and usability of this really cool, I'll call it a tool, but it's just a really powerful concept. I got it. I understand now where shared security fits in this multi-chain question. And that's cool.
Cool, man. This is going to be a blast to explore. And there's so much innovation that's going on in that space as well. So I'm just really pumped to talk about that this season. All right. Here's one more that we've already sort of covered because it's a little bit of a catch-all, but it's an important question. It's this idea of chain abstraction. So again, it's the idea that I think a lot of people have implicitly accepted this assumption that we are not, the user experience of operating crypto today sucks. Chain abstraction, it's almost like if you're coming from an Ethereum background and it's account abstraction, how can we abstract away this sort of technical spec of Ethereum, the idea of accounts and transactions? Like, chain abstraction goes one layer deeper and says, if we're going to be in a world of multiple chains, how can we abstract that experience entirely away from the user? And we're gonna hear from some folks in both Cosmos and Near, actually, that are doing this. And we'll let them define it. It's kind of a catch-all for this idea of how to abstract this away. But one common element is this idea of multi-chain accounts or interchain accounts, where there is a controller chain where you custody your assets and send commands from, and host chains where those actions actually sort of take place and happen. And I think that the question of what are the implementation details for how that actually happens is a super, super interesting one. So we actually don't need to go much more in detail there. And that'll be the second.
Oh, man, I have so much to say.
No. Yeah. It's actually one of the episodes of this. It's going to be with Sam Hart and Ilya, and it's one of the episodes I'm most excited for this season.
Okay, let me give you my one sentence preview. Right. So, okay, we will let them define chain abstraction, but generally speaking, I think there's this view that, like, at some point, hopefully not super far away, users just use the application and they don't know what blockchain they're talking to. Right. That's great. And back to your analogy of like, all right, so these blockchains are like, they have different trade-offs and we're kind of connecting them. And I think that there's this really interesting path you can take of, is this more like internet systems getting connected or more like financial systems getting connected? And what I mean by that is, if it's internet systems getting connected in this chain abstraction, user just does a thing and then it maybe looks like connecting them as like TCP/IP. We're just sending messages between these blockchains. Right. But if they're like financial systems getting connected, then actually it could look quite different. And this is maybe a little bit more of the intent thing here too, where you're like, the whole idea, back to my bond trading days, is a market maker principles risk. They like fill the user with their own money. User has a really great experience. They're like done. And then the third party actor figures out how to hedge their risk or something like that too. And so I think one of the things I want to push on all this chain abstraction stuff is like, yeah, we're connecting blockchains so users don't even know what blockchain they're talking to. But does this look more like connecting servers with the internet? Or does it look more like connecting financial systems with financial settlement? I think that's going to be super fun.
I don't even know if I have an intelligent way to answer that, but that is such a good question. It's a super, super interesting question and one that I think we should delve super deep into, because blockchains have a little bit of both, don't they? And if you look at it, it is often important the ecosystem that I'm maybe most familiar with here is Cosmos, but there are many instances of general message passing of something that looks like business logic from one chain to another that are critical to the design of applications. Like Stride, for instance, if you liquid stake on Stride, you know, there are message passing that happens across IBC, you know, to go to another blockchain to actually deposit. I mean, they're very mission critical things. So there is a blending, I think, of value and messages that could look like a mix between, frankly, the internet and the financial system. So super interesting question to ask. All right, final question of the season, because this came up a couple times when you and I were having our ideation sessions before this season, is how would we define what a satisfying outcome for crypto, a multi-chain crypto endgame, looks like? And we talked about this initially within the context of intents, where, you know, maybe this will resonate with people who are listening to this podcast. Sometimes when you talk about making things like compromise that feel like compromises, like maybe it's not going to be everyone self-custodying everything and holding all their own assets, and maybe it's okay to let some actors, you know, do things on your behalf, right? Or maybe, you know, within the context of something like Uniswap, it's good enough to have like permissionless systems here. We don't need retails LPing. And I feel like there's this common, as soon as you start to push back and be like, hey, maybe some of those early ideas weren't super pragmatic, people throw their hands up and are like, well, then we should just be in TradFi. And I think what we would like to show is that there's a lot of gray space and area where crypto can improve what exists today without just, you know, making some more pragmatic adaptions to maybe what we originally thought. So, Hart, I would just love to get your thought on, if you had to outline a couple of criteria or specific conditions where, in your mind, crypto will have been successful. Yeah, what would that look like for you?
Maybe I'll get roasted on Twitter for this. Here's my bear case for crypto, right? And like this multi-chain future. My bear case for crypto is we replace the TradFi rails. So like TradFi just uses crypto rails, right? And to be clear, my bear case here is actually like really freaking bullish. Like actually, if you were to replace the TradFi rails with crypto, that's a lot of usage and it's going to make for a better financial system. But I call it my bear case because there's all these risks of these elements happening that I don't agree with like philosophically. So let's call it like permissioning, like a lot of access control through this network or something like that, that isn't this global permissionless financial system that I dream of, but it would still get a ton of usage. Mm. And this does fit with like the multi-chain endgame here, because like, you know, you are seeing like the real world asset narrative and some of the like the BlackRock chain, JP Morgan chain type narratives out there. They kind of fit in this bear case where we're like, okay, we're going to have BlackRock and JP Morgan and then like a couple upstarts run their own chains and their own applications and won't connect them, right? And you're like, all right, that's going to lead to lots of blockchain usage, but it is in a sense deeply unsatisfying because it is not A, permissionless, nor B, super innovative. Like what's the new shit we're getting that's getting created here? The bull case is like YouTube. And I think I'm stealing this from Fred Ersom from a long time ago, right? Forgetting the context. But, you know, on YouTube, before YouTube, you had sitcoms and like rom-coms and movies and stuff. And then YouTube comes around and you have like, you know, people unboxing videos and like all this long tail content that no one even knew was going to exist. I look a little bit like our end game here from like the state of the world I want is, okay, base case is we have financial infrastructure. Bull case is that NFTs, crypto games, ways of supporting artists, all this stuff we can't even imagine is actually enabled by this like efficient, permissionless blockchain infrastructure.
Hmm. All right. I like that a lot. And I'm going to outline for me, I had to think about this a lot. I'm going to outline three specific things that I would want to see out of crypto overall. And you actually gave me one, so I'm literally stealing one from you. But I'm going to say, I think one of the facets that you actually outlined this to me is that one of the big differences between financial system as it exists today is global versus local. And I think one of the big differences that you get from a user standpoint, it's actually much less to me. This is why I don't get really excited about payments, because I'm like, A, I don't think a lot of the people that, I think there's a misunderstanding where the cost for payment systems comes in, and I'm not really sure it's a tech problem. So there's part of me that just thinks that. But also, it's like, that doesn't, it's not like you're getting arduously ripped off within the jurisdiction of US for payments. That's not really, you're not getting charged an arm and a leg for that for the most part. But what I think is really good, if you look at it from a global system, is relying on cryptographic assurances versus local regulatory assurances. So again, this is part of the reason why it's so difficult to explain to people in the US. You know, you can put your money in a brokerage and you have really good assurances based on the legal system that exists here that that's not going to get ripped away from you. But you do not necessarily have that if you live in Russia or some third world country or something like that. Or if you're a Russian, or if you're a Russian central bank, right, relative to the US, right? There's clearly a lot of, it's not very safe from your perspective either. So I think giving everyone a set of uniform assurances for property rights that are based on cryptography and not whatever your local politicians are feeling like at the time, that is a super strong value proposition. Then I think another value proposition is distributed ownership. So, you know, I have these discussions with a buddy of mine, Miles, all the time, but I would love it if like tokens just decreased the friction in issuing equity to the point where we rewrote our laws around issuing equity, what defines a security, and making it easier to distribute to employees and even customers. Like, we need to take a hard look at these laws around equity because they make no sense. Three is just transparency. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. Like, creating a system where there's just, you know, 100 times more transparency. All of those things, if we got that out of crypto, I'd be happy. Like, those would be good enough for me.
Hell yeah, Mike. And before I forget, on the transparency point, remind me, I won't do it now, but to say, like, the on the Goldman trading floor, when middle of financial crisis, and our swaps desk, one of the best swaps desks in the world, having like zero idea what their risk is, like within the nearest $100 million mark, right? And the lack of transparency caused by a legally enforced financial system, where in crisis mode, legal enforcement, the ability to rely on that basically goes to zero. Like, it addresses like two of your points around the problems with the financial system that is based on legal enforcement and the lack of transparency because of that. So we'll save that for later in the season.
Yeah. Leave some alpha for listeners. You know, one thing that I would be curious about, and start to wind down here, is, you know, historically people have viewed crypto as a sort of a counter reaction to government overreach. I think that's probably a good way to view it, but it's something very separate from government. I think probably, you know, crypto is just a coordination system. I think ultimately I'm very interested to see what happens when government becomes a stakeholder within crypto economic systems like that. Cause I've never viewed, like, I'm not an anarchist here. I'm not here to end government. Like, that would suck. But I'm interested to see, you know, there's an interesting, the global nature of crypto, you know, kind of pits game theory against one government versus the other. And I think Olaf Carlson, had a great example of, you know, these incentives systems that like suck you in and you become sort of working within this incentive complex that, you know, Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever creates. And I'm excited to see when government ultimately ends up getting sucked into the incentive vortex, because I think it probably will. I think it actually is happening already.
Totally, man. Totally. Like, you know, economics, I look at as economics is a study of how to incentivize human behavior. Blockchain systems are a really interesting tool for incentivizing human behavior. I mean, you could get some philosophers on here too, right? Like, religion, interesting tool for incentivizing human behavior. Yeah. Our Western liberal democracies, interesting tool for incentivizing human behavior, capitalism, interesting tool. But generally speaking, I agree with you that crypto systems use financial incentives to incentivize human behavior in really fascinating ways. And there is absolutely, government will use this to incentivize human behavior in a societal construct. I hope the government uses it in a reasonable, not dystopian way. That'd be nice.
Same. Me too. Me too, man. Well, Hart, this is going to be, I'm just so pumped for the season. I think we're doing a good job of breaking off some, you know, in the weeds sort of technical components. There'll be some very technical episodes, but also we want to do a good job of zooming out and setting context for you, the viewer, about why we're talking about all this. And, you know, hopefully, you know, the goal for these seasons always is for Hart, you and I to maybe update, learn some stuff, or maybe update some of our priors. And for everyone listening, if you're going in with a very specific worldview about how this is all going to play out, you know, we hope you at least think hard and maybe ideally even change some of your opinions. That'd be a good outcome.
Hell yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. Pumped. All right, everyone. Excited to have you along the ride with us. First episode is going to be Chris Goes of Anoma, and that's coming out next week. So make sure you tune in for that.
Thanks, Mike.